this, I get goosebumps. The idea that genocide could in any way be seen as normal initially seems outrageous. But then I realize she means normal in the sense of normalizing, of creating a social norm, like the norms of discrimination about which Scotty Nell and I wrestled in Virginia. Once initiated, violence generates an evolution in perpetrators, Minnick continues. Social norms, institutions, and culture all change in ways that make greater violence easier and more likely. This is also the diagnosis of psychologist Donald Dutton, another expert on genocide. Behavior towards the victim that would previously have been considered inconceivable, he writes, now becomes acceptable and normal. Eventually, killing the victims becomes the right thing to do. As genocide scholar James Waller puts it, perpetrators of extraordinary evil are extraordinary only by what they have done, not by who they are. Observing war crimes tribunals after the Bosnian genocide in 1995, Croatian writer Slavenka Draculic observed, "You sit in a courtroom, watching a defendant day after day, and at first you wonder, as Primo Levi did, if this is a man. No, this is not a man, it is all too easy to answer. But as the days pass, you find the criminals become increasingly human. Soon, you feel that you know them intimately. You watch their faces, ugly or pleasant, their small habits of yawning, taking notes, scratching their heads, cleaning their nails, and you have to ask yourself, what if this is a man? The more you know them, the more you wonder how they could have committed such crimes, these waiters and taxi drivers, teachers and peasants in front of you. And the more you realize that war criminals might be ordinary people, the more afraid you become. Of course, this is because the consequences are more serious than if they were monsters. If ordinary people committed war crimes, it means that any of us can commit them." As I reflect on how normal genocide can become, I think about the history of the United States. During our colonial era and early history as a nation, collective evil was also a norm, from the mass slaughter of Native peoples to the mass enslavement of Africans. Later, between 1877 and 1950, at least 3,959 black people were killed in racial terror lynchings, which Paul Robeson and other civil rights activists argued met the definition of genocide under United Nations conventions. These lynchings weren't just shamefully carried out in the shadows, but as public celebrations. Large crowds of white people, often numbering in the thousands, gathered to witness pre-planned heinous killings that featured prolonged torture, mutilation, dismemberment, and/or burning of the victim, the Equal Justice Initiative reports in its extensive documentation of lynchings in the United States. As Tuskegee University sociologist Stuart Tolney and E.M. Beck reported in their book about lynchings in the South, white press justified and promoted these carnival-like events, with vendors selling food, printers producing postcards featuring photographs of the lynching and corpse, and the victims' body parts collected as souvenirs. The white folks in the audience, like the white folks actually committing the lynchings, likely thought themselves to be good people. White parents brought their kids to watch, which they did, likely thought themselves to be good parents. They were participating in and perpetuating what had become the norm. That doesn't make them innocent. What it makes them, for that time and place, is normal. The frightening power of our desire to conform even to dangerous norms was shockingly, and I mean that literally, demonstrated in a set of famous experiments conducted by psychologist Stanley Milgram in the 1960s. Disturbed by Hannah Arendt's reporting about how supposedly normal Adolf Eichmann was, Milgram decided to test the degree to which people would obey authority figures who instructed them to commit violence. When subjects arrived for Milgram's study, they were put in pairs and drew straws to find out who would play the teacher and who would be the learner. Except the draw was actually fixed. The subjects were always the teacher, and one of Milgram's research assistants was always the learner. Each subject saw the learner put in a room and strapped to a chair with electrodes attached to his arms. Then the subject was brought into a room next door, which contained a machine that appeared to generate electric shocks applied to the learner. The machine was marked from 15 volts, slight shock, to 375 volts, danger, severe shock, to 450 volts, XXX. The machine was actually a fake. It didn't really do anything. but the subjects thought it was real. The subject teachers were supposed to teach a list of word pairs to the learner and then quiz him. Every time the learner got the answers wrong, the subjects were told to administer a shock. The learner gave wrong answers most of the time, on purpose. And if subjects refused to administer a shock, they were given prompts like, "The experiment requires you to continue," and even, "You have no other choice but to continue." Milgram hypothesized that maybe 10% of the participants would go so far as to administer the supposedly lethal shock level of 450 volts. In actuality, 65% did. And every single one of the subjects went to at least 300 volts. Ultimately, Milgram carried out 18 versions of the study, all with similar results. But that was then, right? Unfortunately, no. Ethical standards in academic research in the United States have gotten tougher since the 1960s, in part because of studies like Milgram's. But in 2017, a group of researchers basically replicated Milgram's experiment in Poland, where I guess they don't have such strict standards. In that experiment, 90% of subjects were willing to apply the highest voltage shock. Milgram argued that his studies revealed how intent so many people are to be obedient to authority. Before him, another researcher, Solomon Ash, whose work Milgram had drawn on, showed that authority figures don't even have to be directly involved to induce conformity. Peer pressure is enough. In the 1950s, Ash conducted a groundbreaking experiment, which, as with the Milgram studies, is one of the most widely cited in social psychology. Each subject was brought into a room with people who they thought were other subjects, but who are actually part of the research team. Ash showed them all three lines of clearly different lengths, and then a fourth line that was obviously the same as one and only one of the first three. Everyone was supposed to say which it matched, which was basically a stupidly simple task. The correct answer was really obvious. But when the Confederates in the room deliberately gave the wrong answer, the subjects would also answer incorrectly 32% of the time. Across 12 similar experiments, 25% of the subjects never conformed, but 75% of subjects gave the wrong answer at least once. What was going on in their minds? Were they aware that they were conforming to the norm, just going along to get along? Or did they honestly think they were giving the correct answer? A half century after Ash's experiment, psychiatrist Gregory Burns and his team at Emory University replicated Ash's study while subjects had their brains scanned with an fMRI machine. In this case, they were comparing what looked like Tetris pieces, drawings of two different 3D objects. The subjects were told to mentally rotate the objects to determine if they were the same or different. Again, the correct answer was super clear. But when the accomplices in the room gave the wrong answer, the subjects also answered incorrectly 41% of the time. Burns figured that if the subjects were lying, the part of the brain associated with conscious deception would light up. But it didn't. Instead, the parts of the brain associated with visual perception and spatial awareness lit up. In other words, the subjects weren't lying. The data suggests their minds were genuinely modifying their actual perceptions to conform with the group. If the rest of the group insisted they saw a triangle, the subjects who went along with the group literally saw a triangle too. Meanwhile, the subjects who went against the group showed brain activity in the right amygdala, suggesting that there's an emotional toll, potentially even fear, associated with standing up for one's beliefs. Notably, when Burns and his team performed a version of the experiment in which subjects were tested against computers instead of human researchers, the amygdala didn't light up. The research team concluded that it's not taking a stand in general, but going against one's peers that causes emotional distress. Psychologists Christian Crandall and Amy Eshelman studied 105 different kinds of prejudice as they played out in different scenarios, like job discrimination or laughing at hateful jokes, and found that prejudice was highly correlated with the need for social approval from the dominant group, which apparently can occur subconsciously. Let's be clear, our tendency toward conformity isn't necessarily bad. Societies depend on a degree of conformity. If 25% or even 10% of us decided on a regular basis to disobey traffic lights, we'd have a serious problem. It's conforming to harmful norms that we want to resist. In Rwanda, some people acted with remarkable courage. At the all-girls St. Marie School, Hutu and Tutsi students refused to follow a militia's orders to separate themselves into ethnic groups. So all the girls were killed, taking a stand together. Over the course of the genocide, Josephine Dusseminama, a Hutu woman, hid 13 Tutsis in her home and then secretly ferried them onto boats across the border to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Another Hutu woman, Olive Mukankusi, rescued 3 Tutsis, hiding them in a pit in her backyard that was used for making banana beer. Mukankusi knew the risk she was taking, and she told NPR, "I was ready to die with them, whatever would happen to me or my family." What would make it likely, in those moments, for more of us to demonstrate such nonconformist courage? There is no simple answer, but one clue could be in what genocide scholar Erwin Staub has found, that many rescuers are themselves on the margins of society, like members of a minority religion or people with multi-ethnic heritage. For instance, during Rwanda's genocide, most Hutus among Rwanda's Muslim minority not only didn't participate in killings, but helped hide and rescue both Muslim and non-Muslim Tutsis. Social psychologists Aurelia Mock and Michael Morris have produced strong research evidence that supports Staub's observation. They presented Asian American subjects with pairs of 3D objects, like those in the Burns fMRI study, two Tetris shapes that were clearly exactly the same or different. And as in the Burns, Ash, and Milgram studies, Mock and Morris had researchers pretending to be subjects who would then give the wrong answers. Remember that in Ash's study, 75% of subjects went along with the obviously incorrect answer at least once. But Mock and Morris got different results. They found that Asian American subjects who demonstrated low bicultural identity integration, meaning that they don't see their Asian and American identities as fully compatible and integrated into one social identity, were more likely to resist peer pressure and give the correct answer no matter what the Confederates did. This makes the case that the way to stop us from discriminating against or hating various identity groups isn't actually to pretend that those different identities don't exist. The lesson is not that we need some people who feel like outsiders or who haven't fully integrated their sense of cultural affiliation into a seamless whole. Indeed, having low bicultural identity integration is associated with greater rates of anxiety and depression. The lesson is that we need to combat negative otherizing without forcing assimilation or conformity. We can still have groups. The problem is when they are pitted against one another as dominant versus inferior. Research by anthropologist Jenny Burnett suggests that fostering values of mutual humanity and respect can also counter hate. That was certainly the case, Burnett found, in Rwanda, where she extensively interviewed Hutus who were rescuers. They almost all said it's what any decent human being would do, Burnett reports. They all saw themselves as a certain kind of person. As one rescuer told her, the first reason why some people saved others is because they understood that every person is like themselves, and that if he was being hunted today, it's maybe because you could also be hunted the following day. That if he dies today, you can die tomorrow. We understood that no one has the right over another person's life. Another rescuer said, the one who had a beastly heart didn't save the person, but the one who had a merciful heart, which understood that a human being is a human being, saved that person. That's how we saved people. Several of the studies have suggested that genocide rescuers are more compassionate and altruistic than average. Dehumanization isn't a way of talking, it's a way of thinking, a way of thinking that sadly comes all too easily to us, writes philosopher David Livingston Smith. But the challenge, as Elizabeth Minnick teaches us, isn't just to replace one set of banisters with another, like some uniformly enforced kumbaya assimilation crap that erases individuality. Rather, the question is how we as people and as societies help make habits out of independent thinking, how we can use the spaces in which we come together, from schools to churches to nations, to simultaneously understand how we're all connected to each other and at the same time learn how to think independently. That's a tall order. High in the hills near his village, John Gironeza found other Tutsis who had fled. And they, too, wanted to mount a resistance. but they were untrained and poorly armed, and before long Hutu militants found John and his group. The Tutsis fought as hard as they could, but most of them were slaughtered. John was shot in the head, and his leg was severely cut by a machete. He fell to the ground, unconscious. The Hutu militants assumed John was dead and left him among the other corpses. Eventually, another group of Tutsis came across the scene and noticed John was breathing. They brought him to a hospital in Kigali. John remained in a coma for 135 days. He woke up just weeks after the genocide ended. He'd survived. 7 out of 10 Tutsis in Rwanda would not be so lucky. And after the genocide, there were 95,000 orphans in Rwanda. When John awoke from his coma, he had nothing. Most of his family was dead, and all their property was destroyed or looted. Only 20 years old, John became what Rwandans call a street boy, a homeless kid wandering Kigali. "I lived in Nyanza landfills, where I was eating garbage," John tells me. "Hotels and hospitals would dump their trash wrapped in big tarps, and John and other street boys would string the tarps across trees for shelter and then forage the trash for scraps of food. This is how he lived for 14 years. It was a life too hard to live," John says as his eyes look toward the ground. "I attempted to commit suicide on 10 occasions, but was unsuccessful because God knew I would be here with you today." He looks up at me, his saucer-like eyes sadly smiling. "It was very hard," he says. "But finally, my heart was healed." A year after the genocide, Bishop Gashagaza Deo, who everyone calls Pastor Deo, started Prison Fellowship Rwanda, a group that opposes violence and promotes reconciliation. Pastor Deo had grown up in the Democratic Republic of the Congo with his Tutsi family, who had fled Rwanda in 1959. In 1994, when the genocide ended, Pastor Deo went to Rwanda to find his other relatives. But they'd been killed. He cried for 3 days, then heard a voice that said, "Do not cry. You'll be my instrument for reconciliation." Pastor Deo tells me this with a smile that suggests he knows I might be thinking he's crazy, but in this deeply religious country, no one bats an eye about hearing messages from God. Pastor Deo went into Rwanda's prisons thinking he might find the people who killed his family and also test the message he'd received. He ended up ministering to Hutus in prison. They wanted Pastor Deo to pray for their forgiveness. And, he says, they also wanted his help. "One day, if I am released," one genocidaire said, "how can I live in my home when my victim has nowhere to sleep?" And so, reconciliation villages were born. In 2005, Pastor Deo and the Rwanda Prison Fellowship constructed their first reconciliation village, a community of homes half for genocide perpetrators, half for survivors. Pastor Deo's idea spread, and eventually the Rwanda Prison Fellowship built 8 such villages. When construction started on one in the area where John's family had once lived, community members told Pastor Deo about John and that they'd heard he was now living on the streets and barely surviving. Pastor Deo and his team set out to find John. "They started coming to visit me," John recalls. "However, in the first few days, I tried to hide myself in fear that they were with policemen. In Kigali, the police would regularly harass and arrest homeless people." But soon, John realized the people who came back day after day asking around for him were from his village. "Then we started interacting," says John. Pastor Deo and the Reconciliation Village offered John a house, a place to live in the new village near his family's old home, for free. John was skeptical. Wouldn't you be? Also, he wanted nothing to do with Hutus. He was terrified of them. After he finally relented out of desperation and moved to the Reconciliation Village, he kept a machete next to his bed at night, convinced one of his Hutu neighbors would try to murder him in his sleep. He was that afraid of them, and, understandably, angry. The Reconciliation Village in which John lives is a grid of 100 or so tin-roofed houses with walls made of mud bricks that have been plastered over with concrete. Each house has 3 or 4 rooms with walls and doorways between them, but no doors. In most of the houses I visit, there are bedsheets hung in the doorways. The houses have pit latrines, but no running water. Near the center of the village is a well that everyone uses, lugging 5-gallon yellow plastic jerry cans filled with well water back to their homes. The floors are dirt. The yards are dirt. The streets are dirt. When school isn't in session, the kids from the village pool in little groups and spend most of the days playing in the dirt, poking it with sticks, crawling through it on their knees. I thought of Willa and wished she was in the village with me so she could realize how lucky she is and not whine the next time I refused to get her a bazillionth stuffed animal at the toy store. When I visited John, I brought his village the first soccer ball they'd ever had. It cost me $6. Half of Rwandans live on less than $2 a day. And almost 90% of the country attends church. Soon after he moved into the Reconciliation Village, John started attending church services led by Pastor Deo. A month in, John heard Pastor Deo give a speech. He said that if you don't forgive, you will not be forgiven by God, John recalls. That was it. John decided he was ready. As soon as I pronounced that word, I have forgiven, my heart became clean, he tells me. And he says that he went from seeing the Hutus around him as potential killers to seeing them as nice people. Really? I ask incredulously. Like with Arno Michaelis and Bassam Aramin, this swiftness is hard for me to process, even more so given the extreme horror John has been put through. John suffered to a degree I can't even fathom, which makes me feel indignant for him and for all the Tutsis who lost their loved ones and their own lives. It just seems unfair that John should have to forgive anyone. Like what my friend Amina Tau So said, that in the face of that kind of hate, hating maybe isn't only justified, but just. If you don't hate, are you a hero or a sucker? And is it ridiculous, even possibly offensive, to suggest that someone like John should be celebrated and held up as a role model for shouldering the burden of forgiveness? I can't help thinking that the Hutus who live around him should be groveling at his feet with apologies every single day. That something about praising John for being so magnanimous puts too much of a burden on him and lets the killers off the hook. Forgiveness is a complicated thing. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote that forgiveness is weakness. Going a step further, the writer Audre Lorde suggests that forgiveness is injustice. Black and third world people are expected to educate white people as to our humanity. Women are expected to educate men. Lesbians and gay men are expected to educate the heterosexual world. The oppressors maintain their position and evade their responsibility for their own actions. There is a constant drain of energy which might be better used in redefining ourselves and devising realistic scenarios for altering the present and constructing the future. Personally, I realize that anger makes those holding the anger sick. It weakens our body's immune system and leads to higher blood pressure, stress, and anxiety. Yet, forgiveness sometimes feels to me like a perversion of justice disguised as spiritual grace. Expecting the oppressed to forgive the oppressor feels like yet another burden to put on the oppressed. So as I listen to John tell his story, this forgiving thing feels messed up, which I mentioned to John. He shrugs in response, as if to say that I can think whatever I want to think, but this is what's right for him. John adds that it was not only Pastor Deo's preaching that affected him. It's also worth mentioning that what they, the prison fellowship, were doing for me contributed to my change. The members of the prison fellowship community had opened their hearts to John, and that, in turn, helped John open his heart to the community, Hutus included. And then in walked Marie-Jeanne Uwamana, the Hutu woman John had known of only as a small girl who lived in the next village. It is during the church services that I heard her name, and I became so curious that I asked people where her family lived, John says about Marie-Jeanne. He's a bit coy telling this part of the story, almost bashful. What's clear is that even though their age difference was more pronounced when they were younger, John had fond notions of Marie-Jeanne. One night, he continues, God showed me Marie-Jeanne. He means in a dream, it seems, but either way, no one else blinks at this notion either. John decided to go court her. 3 days later, he proposed. John and others tell me that such speedy courtship is common in Rwanda, especially in the countryside, and after you've been through so much pain, I understand wanting to rush toward love. But there was one other detail I found almost impossible to fathom. Marie-Jeanne's father had led the Hutu militia that slaughtered John's family. And John knew it. Marie-Jeanne also knew that her father had something to do with the murder of John's family, but she didn't know the details. Either way, she didn't let that stop her. "When I saw him," she tells me about the day John showed up on her doorstep, "I immediately thought that he had come to propose." And she said yes. But she also told him she had to talk with her family. "When I shared the idea with my family members, they could not believe their ears," she recounts. Her mother and sister told Marie-Jeanne exactly what her father had done. They told her everything. Still, she was undeterred. Her family pleaded with her that she couldn't marry John, that he was only proposing to her for revenge and would mistreat her in retaliation. In a phenomenal example of thinking without a banister, Marie-Jeanne says, "I told them that if my father wronged John's family, I was not the one to blame. I came to the conclusion that this had been my father's business, not mine." Marie-Jeanne says she told herself, "If he really loves me, nothing will stop me from marrying him." As the American feminist Robin Morgan writes, hate generalizes, love specifies. Through love, we challenge and let go of all kinds of assumptions, and whatever cynicism I had about John and Marie-Jeanne's rapid courtship was melted away by seeing them together. In the fall of 2016, when I travel to Rwanda and meet Marie-Jeanne and John, they are living in the same house John was given in Pastor Deo's Reconciliation Village. They've been married for 10 years. Their four absolutely adorable little kids keep trying to hide behind the table legs and sneak a look at the gangly white lady with the iPhone and the notebook. Meanwhile, John and Marie-Jeanne's obvious affection for each other is purely enchanting. Marie-Jeanne tells me that her mother and sister have been amazed by the way we live happily together. It is something beyond their imagination. But what of Marie-Jeanne's father, I wonder? Marie-Jeanne has been trying to find him. She believes he's living in Uganda, trying to escape persecution for his crimes during the genocide. Whenever anyone she knows visits Uganda, Marie-Jeanne sends them with whatever scraps of details she has about her father's whereabouts and asks them to try to find him and urge him to come back home. "I do not hate him," Marie-Jeanne tells me. "I cannot hate him." She explains that he was a good dad and a good person, as she knew him. And what about John? Does he hate his wife's father, the cause of so much of his suffering? No, John insists. He seems to have learned a transformative kind of love that perhaps few of us can ever attain. "I really love him so much," John tells me. "The only problem is that I don't have strong legs. If I did, I would even uplift him to show him how much I love him." John hoists his arms enthusiastically in the air to show how high he would lift Marie-Jeanne's father if he could. Nothing is easier than to denounce the evildoer. Nothing is harder than to understand him, wrote Fyodor Dostoevsky. Loving the evildoer who massacred your entire family seems downright impossible. Then a smile fills John's whole face. "I really love the man who gave birth to my beloved wife," he declares. "I feel that John and I will live together forever," Marie-Jeanne tells me as she smiles back at her husband. "People should know that all human beings are to be treated the same way. My desire is to see people love each other the way we do." Genocide scholar Stephen Baum dedicated his book, The Psychology of Genocide, to those who acted as resistors and rescuers during atrocities, whom he refers to as alles goeie mensen, a Dutch phrase he translates as those good people who live above hate. John and Marie-Jeanne have learned to love above hate. Their story would be heartwarming anywhere in the world, but in a nation that once burned so hot with hatred, Marie-Jeanne and John are like two phoenixes rising from the ashes, taking the hope for Rwanda's future under their wings. And how has Rwanda fared post-genocide? Not exactly as well as Marie-Jeanne and John. Though, by many accounts, great strides have been made, tensions and resentments remain. The genocide ended when RPF forces, led by Paul Kagame, overthrew the Hutu government and established an RPF-dominated coalition government. Kagame has been president since 2000, having won a landslide re-election in 2017. He is hailed as a savior by some, but condemned as a tyrant by others. Some of the steps the government has taken to bring about reconciliation have been widely praised. Others have been harshly criticized. The ringleaders of the genocide were tried in the International Criminal Court, but for the hundreds of thousands of others suspected of participating in the killing, the government set up Gashasha courts. Gashasha roughly translates as sitting down to discuss an important issue. The courts were overburdened and imperfect. Many alleged perpetrators died awaiting trial. But in addition to determining guilt and punishment for those convicted, the Gacaca court created a public process for community members to hear what had happened to their loved ones and for communities in general to engage in accountability and healing. Many Tutsi survivors told me that they only found out where the bodies of their family members were buried because of the Gacaca process. And Hutu perpetrators told me it forced them to take responsibility, not just serving their time in prison, but fully facing what they had done and the people they'd done it to. As a Hutu man named Frederick Kazaguemo explained to me, during the Gacaca courts, there were Hutus who were together during the genocide. They were refusing to say that they took the properties of Tutsis. For me, I was judging them because I saw them. And so I said, "You took this, you took this, I was seeing you." More controversial, however, are the government-created Ingando, national re-education camps designed to foster national unity and discourage ethnic distinctions. As Hutu prisoners have been released, they've been required to attend the camps, as have most of the nation's Hutu and Tutsi youth. But the government plan calls for every Rwandan to eventually attend. The idea is to create spaces where Hutus and Tutsis learn together about their connections and combat the hateful ideas spread by genocide propaganda, to share from a common dish, to eat and sleep together. This would build confidence that we could, in fact, live together, as the director of the National Unity and Reconciliation Commission once explained it. Yet some have criticized the Ingando as projects of pro-RPF propaganda, a dangerous undertaking in a country in which political indoctrination and government-controlled information were essential in sparking and sustaining the genocide, writes Fordham University professor and human rights lawyer Chi Mugbako. And there are troubling aspects to the government's promotion of pan-ethnic nationalism. As Mugbako argues, Ingando is dangerous because instead of teaching tolerance for difference, it leads to an obliteration of difference. One Rwandan journalist told Mugbako that the camps are basically brainwashing, and that, yes, it's important for people to put the common good or even the nation above ethnic identity, but, the journalist added, it's wrong to tell people not to identify as what they are. Plus, remember the research showing that those who preserve their distinct identities are more likely to resist groupthink? We must foster group bonds not by imposing a homogenous identity on everyone, but by building a sense of shared humanity that not only respects but actively appreciates everyone's differences, especially because those differences help us resist dangerous groupthink banisters. Has the Rwandan government merely been imposing other types of dangerous conformity? For instance, it's now a crime in Rwanda to point out that as part of their efforts to defeat the Hutu extremist government and take over the country, rebel Tutsi forces also committed atrocities during the period of the genocide. Those atrocities committed by Hutus against Tutsis were unarguably several orders of magnitude worse. But if you go to the genocide memorials and museums in Rwanda, the staff now officially talk about the genocide against the Tutsis as a matter of government policy. And as the New York Times reported, a university professor was sentenced to prison for 5 years after a student reported the professor had said something critical of Paul Kagame. Coming from a country that has never engaged in a national truth and reconciliation process to atone for its founding sin of ethnic cleansing and its sins of slavery and segregation, I'm in no position to point fingers here. I think the progress Rwanda has made in light of its history is remarkable. And despite imperfections, the impact thus far seems positive. I met a number of Tutsi living together peacefully as neighbors with the Hutus who had killed their loved ones, like Leonard Rukagoza and Marie Izagiriza. And even slowly, carefully, restoring their friendships. That's beyond incredible. Still, Rwanda serves as a cautionary tale not only about how readily people can be provoked to commit horrific violence, but also how easily governments, opposition groups, media, and other aspects of society can undermine our ability to think without banisters. This is why, while each of us can and should play our own part in shoring up civility, repudiating hate, and rejecting the banisters that lead to ugliness, understanding how hate is fostered systemically in overt and covert ways, and how deeply hate can be embedded in our institutions is an integral component of combating pandemics. Chapter 6, Systems of Hate, The Big Picture. The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall plunge into the dark abyss of annihilation. Martin Luther King, Jr. When Grace Bell Hardison was born in North Carolina in 1916, black women in the U.S. didn't have the right to vote. In fact, no women did. Even after the 15th Amendment passed in 1870, it granted voting rights only to African-American men. So it wasn't until the 19th Amendment was adopted in 1920 that women, including black women like Grace, could vote. Despite those constitutional guarantees, when Grace reached voting age in 1934, disenfranchisement of black voters was still widespread. In many southern states, including North Carolina, where Grace has lived her whole life, the government mandated literacy tests for voters. These were harder for black folks to pass because they had been discriminated against in the education system. And states adopted poll taxes, requiring voters to pay a fee in order to cast a ballot, another barrier aimed at disenfranchising black voters who were disproportionately poor. If it wasn't clear enough that these laws were meant to inhibit black voters, they included grandfather clauses. If your father or grandfather could vote prior to 1867, you were exempted from the poll taxes and literacy tests. Of course, there were no black voters prior to 1867. The 15th Amendment hadn't been passed yet. This was just a loophole so that poor, illiterate white folks could still vote. It's also a prime example of how an allegedly race-neutral law can be actually extremely discriminatory when taken in context. Meanwhile, the few black citizens who did manage, in spite of all this, to successfully register to vote would find their names published in the local newspaper, which would alert local KKK gangs to then show up at their homes and threaten them with violence. For instance, in 1922, members of the KKK reportedly flew over Topeka, Kansas, and dropped postcards in black neighborhoods warning against voting. If black people did nonetheless manage to try to vote, they often found out that the KKK would make good on their threats. The 1965 Voting Rights Act was supposed to fix all this, specifically outlawing literacy tests and, more generally, prohibiting states or the federal government from enacting any voting laws that either had the intent or effect of discriminating against race or language minorities. And the law established federal oversight for communities in which more than 50% of the non-white population had been stopped from registering to vote. This way, the Department of Justice could keep an eye on states that had historically engaged in widespread disenfranchisement. So the problem was solved, right? Not exactly. The Voting Rights Act did make a huge difference in shifting public norms while creating vital oversight and accountability. But that didn't mean voter suppression stopped. For instance, in the 1980s, the Republican National Committee created the National Ballot Security Task Force, in which off-duty police officers armed with their loaded service revolvers patrolled polling stations in black communities. The party was sued in 1982 for violating the Voting Rights Act. But then just 4 years later, a leaked memo from the Republican National Committee detailed how a new ballot security program in Louisiana would, quote, keep the black vote down. Sure, Republicans had a partisan motivation in suppressing the Democratic vote, but they could have also tried to suppress the white Democratic vote. Arguably, other bias and bigotry was at play here in choosing to suppress the black vote in particular. And perhaps Republicans thought that they could get away with it in a society with a history of not caring about black people and their rights. Questioning the legitimacy of white voters would seem preposterous, but who would bat an eye at questioning the legitimacy of black voters whose very humanity, let alone voting rights, had already been questioned by U.S. society and politics for so long? This tangle of laws and norms and causes and effects is systemic hate. In 2013, Shelby County, Alabama, sued to overturn sections of the Voting Rights Act that had put its electoral practices under federal oversight. The county won. In the landmark ruling Shelby County versus Holder, which gutted major parts of the Voting Rights Act, Chief Justice John Roberts declared, "Our country has changed." Yes, but how much? A year later, Alabama passed a strict requirement that all voters show ID, and then it shut down DMV offices in 80% of the state's blackest counties, making it harder for black residents to get the IDs they were now required to have to vote. It's the kind of move the Voting Rights Act wouldn't have allowed, had it still been fully in effect. All of which brings us to 2016, when the state of North Carolina tried to disenfranchise Grace Bell Hardison. A mailing sent to Grace's home by a mayoral candidate was returned as undeliverable, because Grace used a post office box for her mail. But Republican activists used the returned mailing as evidence to try to have Grace removed from the voting rolls altogether, along with 137 other North Carolina voters they similarly targeted, two-thirds of whom were, like Grace, black and registered as Democrats. Fortunately, Grace fought back, and through her family and the local National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP chapter, got the attention of the media and even then-President Barack Obama. It's a shame that I had to experience this ordeal at 100 years old and over 50 years after the Voting Rights Act was signed into law, Grace wrote in a letter to President Obama. It's also disappointing that other African-American voters are also being targeted in the same way. What does any of this have to do with hate? Efforts to disenfranchise black voters today are inextricably linked to the past, to slavery, and the fact that for centuries black people weren't recognized as full human beings, let alone citizens, with equal civil rights. And then, amidst whatever the other excuses or explanations may be, that systemic marginalization plays out in other forms, from who gets threatened with violence to whose legitimate right to vote is questioned at all. Grace and I have the same exact voting rights. But Grace faces more barriers to voting because of systemic hate. Grace Bell Hardison did manage to cast her vote in the 2016 presidential election. An election official brought a ballot to her as she sat in the passenger seat of a car parked at her polling place. She's 100 years old, after all. A photo of Grace sitting in the car, proudly wearing an I voted sticker, quickly spread around social media, and for good reason. But the photo shows only Grace's individual triumph. What it doesn't show is all the systemic hurdles that Grace and so many other voters have had to maneuver over and that still prevent many people, especially people of color, from voting. Voting is just one example of how hateful otherizing and inequity can be embedded in and fostered by policies and institutions. We see the same embedded history of hate in everything from schools to healthcare to the criminal justice system and more, and not only in terms of discriminating against black people or women. For instance, as we'll see, systemic hate in our institutions and norms in the United States also perpetuates bias against poor and working class white folks in rural communities. We can't just pin institutional bias on the individuals working within those institutions. Certainly that's a factor. As when 18% of Latino registered voters report that they have been told by officials at polling places that they can't vote. But systemic hate is also a product of the systems themselves, whether intentionally or inadvertently, because these systems reverberate and replicate the hate of the past. Racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, discrimination against physically impaired people, economic elitism, and other forms of hate shape our policies and practices and norms, which in turn then perpetuate hate even further. To combat systemic hate, we've got to get better at spotting it, which can be quite difficult because systems are complex. Our analytical minds rarely tend toward a holistic view of complex systems, writes Valerie Hudson, a professor at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University, and her co-authors in the book Sex and World Peace. For example, take a moment and picture a tree. What do you see? Perhaps you envision a tall tree with many leaves and a big straight trunk with long branches. Do you think about the root system that is sometimes larger than the part of the tree above ground, the roots that keep the tree alive? The point of systemic thinking, the authors write, is to see the entire tree. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, a system is defined as, quote, a set of things working together as part of a mechanism or an interconnecting network, or a complex whole. For example, the way that voting rights laws, local election office practices, popular culture around voting, the history of violence against black voters, and the history of racism and white supremacy and black oppression in the United States all interact and interlock. This system not only shapes individual voting patterns, but the entirety of our democracy, which in turn means that when we see problems like low voter turnout, it's wise to widen our analysis to see not only individual behavior and factors, but the systemic variables. For another example of a problem caused by systemic hate, consider the opioid epidemic ravaging many small town and rural white communities. In 1996, the drug OxyContin was first introduced to the market by Purdue Pharmaceuticals. Since then, drug overdoses in the United States have skyrocketed. In 2015, drug overdose was the leading cause of accidental death in the United States. And of the 52,404 Americans who died of drug overdoses in 2015, more than a third were from prescription pain relievers. In fact, the amount of prescription opioids sold has quadrupled, even though reports of pain have not gone up. So what's happening? We could blame the addicts themselves. And, like with black folks not turning out to vote, certainly individual responsibility is a factor. Drug abuse is an individual choice. No one is forcing addicts to swallow pills or put a needle in their arm. Yet, there are also systemic dynamics at play. One is that opioid painkillers are being massively overprescribed by doctors. And bear in mind that if, because of racial bias, doctors are under-prescribing painkillers to African Americans, that means overprescribing then disproportionately affects white communities. In Utah, a state that is almost 150% whiter than the country as a whole, pharmacists fill 7,200 opioid prescriptions per day. That's more than 2.6 million prescriptions per year in a state that only has 3 million residents. Another horrifying example, one pharmacy in Kermit, West Virginia, population 392, received almost 9 million hydrocodone pills in just 2 years. Institutional players like pharmacies and pill distributors could have raised a red flag and intervened, but they didn't. And that's still not the whole picture. Overprescription is also fueled by pharmaceutical companies aggressively promoting the wonders of opioids. They have even founded nonprofits like the American Academy of Pain Management, which has used dubious research to create guidelines for doctors encouraging more aggressive prescribing. Insurance companies also play a role because opioids are generally cheaper than other types of treatment for pain, such as physical therapy, acupuncture, and massage. Insurers reimburse for painkiller prescriptions while limiting coverage for effective and healthy alternative treatments. This problem was so widespread in September 2016 that 37 state attorneys general sent a letter to the head of the insurance industry trade group urging insurers to change this. And the federal government contributes to the problem. Starting in 2014, Medicaid and Medicare inadvertently incentivized hospitals to prescribe opioids to poor and elderly patients. Patient satisfaction surveys, which the government uses to determine reimbursement rates for hospitals, included questions about whether patients felt their pain issues were addressed. Hospitals got paid more when patients reported that their pain was managed. So experts say these questions on the reimbursement survey contributed to increasing opioid prescriptions. In 2017, the government stopped including pain management questions in Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement calculations. But still, the U.S. government has failed to regulate opioid pharmaceuticals aggressively and has, in fact, looked the other way in cases of gross industry abuse, in part because of massive lobbying and campaign spending from these big businesses. But that's not all. The economy also plays a role. Opioid addiction and overdose rates are highest in white communities with high unemployment. A National Bureau of Economic Research study in 2017 found that when unemployment rises in a county, opioid overdoses and deaths rise, too. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen acknowledged the link during congressional testimony, saying of the epidemic, "I do think it is related to declining labor force participation among prime-age workers." Specifically, the counties hardest hit by opioids are rural white communities that have seen their jobs hollowed out by what The Atlantic calls this most recent post-NAFTA era of deindustrialization. The result is that while life expectancy has generally been increasing for all racial and ethnic groups, recently white life expectancy has declined, driven by astronomical drug overdose rates. Again, what does all this have to do with hate? It's not like the doctors and pharmacists in rural white communities hate their neighbors, right? But the fact that this crisis is centered in those communities has everything to do with systemic bias and hate. arguably, it's because of a combination of racism and elitism that we as a country prioritize not only job creation for white people, but job creation for educated middle-class and upper-class white people. Policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement lined the pocket of corporations and their elite executives and investors, while by some accounts destroying over 1 million jobs and worsening economic inequity. If we truly valued the rural white working class, we wouldn't have passed policies that so disproportionately harm them. And even then, if we cared as much about rural white folks as we care about wealthy white coastal elites, we would have noticed sooner that they were dying of a drug epidemic. And instead of passing policies that made it worse, we would have done everything in our power to fix it. Think about even those of us who try to be careful not to say anything anti-black or anti-gay, but who casually and habitually demean rural white folks. That was certainly the mentality behind that dumb fuckistan map I circulated so gleefully. And I'll also admit to having used phrases like podunk and backwoods more than I should have to refer condescendingly to poor white communities. In 2015, Chris Jansen, the white Southern country singer who wrote the pro-Trump theme song for the 2016 Republican National Convention, penned a song called White Trash. One of the lines is, "Well, if they had their way, they'd have us thrown away," which J.D. Vance recounts in his memoir Hillbilly Elegy, is exactly what many rural white folks believe liberal elites think about them. But it's not just liberals. In 2016, National Review's Kevin Williamson, writing about the opioid crisis in rural white America, said, "The truth about these dysfunctional, downscale communities is that they deserve to die." It's arguable that this cultural disdain contributes to the systemic opioid crisis. The United States hates poor black folks and poor white folks, although in different degrees and different forms. Systems that are shaped by hate produce hateful results, unless we stop them. As Grace Bell Hardison exemplifies, we have levers with which we can buck the system. And the more of us who work together, the bigger the levers we can pull. But first we have to see them. Remember Robber's Cave, psychologist Muzaffar Sherif's experiment in which he separated boys into two groups at a summer camp and was able to quickly make them turn against each other and then later unite? It turns out that Sherif had conducted two experiments before Robber's Cave, with dramatically different outcomes. The first was in 1949, 5 years before Robber's Cave, and the second in 1953, the year before Robber's Cave. Sherif considered both of these experiments failures, because despite the best attempts of his research teams to get the boys in the first two experiments to turn on each other, they ended up turning on a third group, the experimenters. In both studies, the boys became suspicious of the men who were supposedly counselors and camp staff because the boys saw the counselors conspicuously observing them with recorders and notepads. For instance, in the 1953 study, at the phase where Sherif and his team intended to turn the groups of boys against each other, when researchers vandalized the camp of one group, expecting the boys to blame the other group, the boys figured out that they were being manipulated by Sherif's team. They told the other group, and together they complained. What's more, the boys started to suspect that the camp was some sort of experiment, asking questions of the researchers about why they were taking notes and why there were microphones hanging from the ceiling of the mess hall. Their suspicions were confirmed when one of the boys found a staff notebook of research observations. Sherif quickly disbanded the study. In his analysis of all three of the studies, social psychologist Michael Billig makes an important point. Sherif's experiments didn't include just two groups, but rather three. The experimenters themselves were a group, and the most powerful one at that, in effect operating as and controlling the larger camp system with an express goal of stirring up conflict. In the final version of the study, Sherif successfully figured out how to more subtly conduct the research observations and at the same time generate conflict without the boys realizing they were being manipulated, in effect making his systemic role invisible within its context. Like the systems in a real society that stir hate and conflict without us even noticing. There are two important takeaways from the totality of Sherif's studies. One is that often what we believe is natural conflict is the result of groups being intentionally pitted against one another by forces that have a vested interest in creating conflict. The other is that these manipulations, as well as the ways in which our systems are constructed to foster hate, can be so subtle that they're extremely difficult to detect. The kids in Sheriff's first two studies were indignant that they were being manipulated and that the whole camp was a setup, which led them to stop fighting each other and instead fight the system. That's what we all need to do. Become acutely aware of how our institutions and norms and otherwise invisible social mechanisms are pitting us systemically against one another. Feel deeply indignant about it and attack those systems instead of each other. But first, we have to unmask systemic hate so that we can help unite in opposing it. I spent the first part of my career as a community organizer because as I looked at our economic, social, and political problems, it was clear they required the sort of large-scale change that is only possible when large groups of people together unmask and oppose hate. The disproportionate wealth gap between white families and black families, the way undocumented immigrants are lured into the country by U.S. businesses and then denied basic rights, how women are paid less and given less opportunity for advancement than men. These are all problems that individual initiative alone can't solve. My first real project as a community organizer was helping LGBT employees in businesses and government agencies lobby their employers to create domestic partnership benefits plans so that LGBT employees could include their partners on their health insurance and other workplace benefits. This wasn't something individuals could do alone. They couldn't just one by one create exceptions to corporate and government policies. But when they came together to press their case, employees were able to win change. Those victories were important, but even they were limited to one employer at a time. One of the many reasons to push for marriage equality was to achieve equal benefits not just company by company or local government by local government, but all at once for everyone. But that took even more people pushing. Community organizing is premised on the belief that collective problems can be solved only through collective action that pushes for collective solutions. The solutions throughout this book, Connection Speech, Connection Spaces, and Connection Thinking, get us part of the way toward the opposite of hate. But we also need big picture solutions that broadly change policies, institutions, and cultural norms. That's where connection systems come in. We need to enact laws and institutional practices and promote social and cultural norms more broadly that recognize we're all fundamentally equal and at the same time help us respect and relate to each other's differences. That looks like everything from overturning laws that have perpetuated inequity and injustice to passing policies that support inclusion and integration to making sure people get equal pay and communities get equal resources to reforming institutions that incentivize divisiveness and hate. Consider the systemic problem of school segregation and inequity. Recall that when Scotty Nell Hughes and I went to the Moton Museum in Farmville, Virginia, we learned about the history of Brown versus Board of Education and how, in the face of courts forcing racial integration in schools, white people desperately looked for ways to preserve segregation. That didn't just happen in the South. As more and more African Americans fled the South and moved north during the Great Migration throughout the early 1900s, white folks in the North also moved into all-white suburbs and exurbs because they didn't want to live next to black families, and they didn't want their kids in school with black kids. This white flight, encouraged by government and banking policy, reshaped public education for generations. So just as the Brown decision was mandating formal integration, white folks were physically self-segregating to try to avoid Brown's reach. Meanwhile, public schools in the South were at one point some of the most integrated in the United States, mainly because of federal court orders. But since 2000, judges have released hundreds of school districts from Mississippi to Virginia from court-enforced integration, reports ProPublica, a public interest journalism organization. And without oversight, many of those districts headed straight back toward segregation. A result is that today in the United States, more than one out of every 10 black and Latino students attend so-called apartheid schools, in which whites make up less than 1% of enrollment. Incidentally, most of these schools are not in the South, but in the Northeast and Midwest. And across the country, because so-called apartheid schools are in disproportionately poor communities, and because school funding is apportioned mostly through local property taxes, apartheid schools receive less funding than wealthy white schools. Bear in mind, it's not just because of income inequality that black families are forced into poor neighborhoods, but because property taxes are determined by home values, and those values have been affected by decades of redlining policies in the United States through which banks and the government colluded to relegate black families to certain neighborhoods and then devalue property in those neighborhoods. The result is that, for instance, the wealthy school district in Greenwich, Connecticut spends $6,000 more per pupil per year than the poor district in Bridgeport, Connecticut, just a few miles away. Meanwhile, nationwide, the achievement gap between black and white students, which greatly narrowed during the era in which schools grew more integrated, widened as they became less so. Education scholar Jonathan Kozel reports that he's often asked about school inequity